Welcome to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast, where we aim to give swimming the coverage and publicity it deserves. Every week, we celebrate the sport we love with amazing special guests and topics from around the swimming pool. And now, here are your hosts, Scott and Dan.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott, and on this week's show, we are joined by another guest. We are joined by Jack Bridge, who is a former para swimmer for GB. He competed at London 2012 and was a former international para swimming medalist. So welcome to the show, Jack. How are you?
Thanks very much for having me. Yeah, it's really good to be on the show. And yeah, I'm great, mate. I'm good. I'm looking forward to this chat that we're going to have.
So in this week's podcast, we're going to talk through with Jack a bit more about his swimming career, kind of his classifications, how that affected his swimming. And then we are going to look to Jack to help explain a bit more about the world of para swimming, because during our Manchester kind of live stream coverage of the international meet there, both me and Dan found that not just our knowledge, everyone's knowledge wasn't quite up to the level that it could be in the world of para swimming. So we're gonna turn to Jack, who is going to speak to us about classifications, the point system, and all the above. So no pressure, Jack.
I'll try my best. Yeah, absolutely. I'll try my best.
Great stuff. So why don't we start off with yourself? What classification did you have in the world of para swimming, and kind of how did that impact your swimming?
Okay, so I suffer from a bleeding condition called hemophilia. Yeah. Basically, what that is your blood has lots of different proteins that do lots of different jobs. And I'm missing the protein that specifically looks after internal clotting. So if I cut myself, I'll form a scab like anybody else. You know, I'll bleed and form a scab. But if I have a trauma or a bang, that's where it becomes a little bit more difficult.
Right.
So as everybody else's blood will form like a big purple bruise, if I don't have my treatment that I take, that would just be get really like ruby red and keep growing that bleed until it got very serious. And it's really serious if I hit my head or if blood gets into the joint space.
Okay.
And as a young boy, I had a few what we call bleeds into my left elbow, my left knee, and my right ankle. And you have cartilage in between those bones, which acts as like a lubricant between the two bones. And when blood comes into contact with the cartilage, it's really, really acidic because of the iron in the blood, and it breaks down the cartilage. And when bits of the cartilage break off, the body thinks that the bone's broken. So it sends lots of calcium and lots of protein to that space. And you end up growing what we call osteophytes. And then eventually you end up with osteoarthritis, and it leaves your joints rather painful and sometimes fixed. So I can't straighten my left arm. That's as far straight as it goes there. And it's a similar story with my left leg. So my left knee is pretty much the same as my elbow, and my right ankle is pretty immobile too. But in the world of Paris, so as I said, I was an able-bodied swimmer from the age of four when I started to learn, all the way through to 2015, racing against other people, able-bodied. And I always knew I was at a massive disadvantage, because if, you know, you put me next to someone who's in a streamlined position, you can just see the just irregularities there. So I was at a competition in Salford, and one of the referees said to my parents, look, he's swimming, you know, against really good able-bodied swimmers. Is at a decent level? Is at county level, regional level? But he's swimming at such a disadvantage. It's unbelievable. So just go and try and get him to get him classified. Because I was at that point in my life, I was 15. I was just about to go and do my GCSEs. And it was, did I have time to do the early mornings, the late nights, put in all the effort that I wanted to just to be a good regional swimmer? Not really. So my eye was pretty much off the ball with swimming. And because swimming's the best sport someone with hemophilia can do, my parents, as a last ditch, said, come on, let's just try and get you classified just to keep you in the sport.
Okay.
And I was classified in Sheffield. So in terms of the classification system for para swimming, there's three different types. You've got physical disability, then there's a visual impairment, and there's people with learning difficulties. Right. So classifications S1 to S10 are people with physical impairments. So S1 is someone who has no arms and legs, for example, and S10, someone like me, who they do have an impairment, but it's fairly minimal in comparison to not having a limb or, you know, no limbs.
Yeah.
So from S11 to S13, S11 is someone who is completely blind, through to S13, who, from what I'm led to believe, it's like if you put Vaseline on your lenses, on your goggles, that's pretty much all they can see, like, all the time.
Right, okay.
And then S14 are athletes with learning difficulties.
Right.
So anything from, like, Asperger's through to, you know, a multitude of different learning difficulties.
Yeah, yeah. So with your condition, how important is it that you get your kind of daily training and for you to have that constant kind of athletic involvement that swimming gives you?
Yeah, it was really, really important. And it was a case of learning what my body could do. So initially when I started swimming, I was a really keen footballer. I played cricket. So I had trials for my local football team, Preston North End. I'd got cricket in the family. So my cousins played test cricket for England. And I was fairly good. I played just below county level. But the one thing that allowed me to do those sports was my swimming, because that was the one thing that gave me my, you know, basic cardiovascular system, fitness. And it also strengthened my muscles in the places where I could have had issues. So, all the way through my early childhood and into my early teens was a case of, you can do these other sports as long as you kept your swimming up, because it, you know, gave me that ability to do it. And once I'd kind of let those other sports go, swimming just became my whole life. So, as I'm sure it's the case with every elite athlete, you can't be amazing at something unless you put the time and dedication into something. And I think someone wrote that to be truly world-class, you need to put at least 10,000 hours into one particular sport. So for me, it was a case of, like I said, that weekend in 2009, when I got classified, I didn't know I was going to make the team in at London. But I wanted to give myself every single opportunity to go away and work hard to make sure that, you know, come April 2012, my name was on the team sheet.
Yeah. So were you part of, like, the elite training program that GB Swimming has? Is that kind of afforded to the same level that an able-bodied swimmer would have?
Yep. So that's all set up by UK Sport, just the same as it would be sport that, you know, that compete at either a winter or summer Olympic or Paralympic Games. Obviously, the budgets for each individual sport is set by UK Sport, dependent on God knows what factors sometimes.
I think it's a medal haul from the last Olympics or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's obviously there's a disparity between the Olympic sport and Paralympic sport, but that's probably, you know, down to giving Paralympic time enough, you know, just needs time to grow and become more commercial, and then more money will be, you know, afforded to Paralympic sport. But yeah, so each athlete so if you're on those world-class programs, each athlete is treated exactly the same, whether you're an able-bodied swimmer or you're a para swimmer, you still have the same level of athlete personal award or as it was back then. And you are supported to the same level as long as you're at the same department in the sport, pretty much. So I was initially part of the world-class talent program, got put on that in early 2000. And then I got put on the development program the year of 2011, just before I got onto the European team in Berlin in 2011. So it was an absolutely amazing experience, met some amazing people and made some friends for life on those programs and those weekends away, those trips to New York or on training camps or South Africa or wherever we went. Very, very special times to me.
So were you kind of interacting with able bodies as well at the same time?
Yep. So I trained at the performance program was called Gallica, and then it moved in, it like joined in with Preston Swimming Club's performance program. So I was training with other able-bodied athletes. There was no other para swimmers in my swim program in the lead up to London, which was great because we had a couple of breaststrokers, Rebecca Swales and Jack Smith, who we'd form a little trio. And we just do our breaststroke sessions together. And Jack was on the brink of the GB team. So he went to some GB junior events. I think he was on a team with Adam Peaty the year of 2012. They went away to France. And Jack was someone for me to look up to all the time and chase, whether we were doing speed work or whether we were doing more distance-based work for, you know, our back 50 of the 100. He was more of a 200 breaststroker. So to have someone in that, you know, for me to kind of chase all the time was Like, it was amazing. I couldn't have asked for a better group. And the whole group, we're all pretty similar ages and we're all going through the same things at the same time in terms of, you know, going through school together, going through exams at the same point in time. And to have that understanding from your teammates was something very, very special.
So it definitely helped kind of your swimming career progress that there was no discrimination and separation between the squads. It kind of pushed, it pushed you forward.
Yeah, there was no reason. There was no reason for there to be. I don't think it's the case all the way through the Paris swimming program, because it's not reasonable to ask anybody probably above an S8 or an S9 to train in an able body program.
Yeah.
I might be doing some lower classifications of people a disservice by saying that. Anything above an S8 or an S9, it just isn't reasonable in terms of having to cater for their specific impairments and disabilities in that program. So at the time we had two performance centers. We had one in Manchester and one in Swansea, and they had a mixture of athletes, whether it was people or athletes with learning difficulties, or I think Ellie Simmons was based in Swansea. We had people like Tom Young, Natalie Massey, Dan Pepper. They were based in Manchester. So wherever we went for our training camps, we always had that kind of elite group of athletes to look up to as well, which was cool. But for me, during that period in the lead up to London, that the time and effort and emotions that I put into swimming and those training sessions with my teammates back then was, like I say, very, very special.
So leading up to London 2012, let's get on to that moment because we can't avoid it. How good was it to qualify for the home Olympics to start with? Was that because a lot of swimmers talk about the trials as being the biggest hurdle? That's the most pressure on them, is the trials. How was that feeling for you? Was it a moment of release and then you could enjoy the games, or was it kind of the other way around?
That's a really good question. I think that the biggest thing for me was, we had qualification standards to reach, but for me at that point in time, I knew I probably wasn't going to reach that kind of A standard that was set at the time. So I qualified as part of the 4x1 medley relay team. Yeah. So I basically knew that was my best opportunity to make the team, which took a hell of a lot of pressure off, because there was no time pressure to go and reach. It was a case of, I just needed to show John Atkinson, the performance director, and the coaches that I was improving. And if we were looking on a trajectory, I was going in one direction. I was only getting faster and faster.
Yeah.
So I just had to go out there, and we had trials in March at London, and I just had to make sure that I just did my best job, where I was just racing against myself. I wasn't racing against any specific time. I just needed to show that I was getting faster and faster and faster, so that by the time the games come around, I was at my peak in terms of my speed and you know, executing those race plans that we put in place. Maybe 18 months before the actual games came around. It was, I remember sitting with my coach Louise in September of 2011 saying, how do you want your race to look in a year's time? And we put some times together, and do you know what? I really wasn't far off where I wanted to be. So again, it's about that being meticulous with your preparation, so that when that moment comes around,
yeah,
you've practiced and rehearsed those actions every single day, so that when you step up on the block in front of 17,500 people, it's as if you're standing in front of 10 people at the North Lancashire Gala meet, you know, when you were like nine or whatever. It's just the same. You just go through the same process.
But surely with that many people there in the moment, was it a little bit daunting? Because I've never swam in front of that many people.
Yeah. So I'll tell you the story of my 100 breaststroke heat, which a lot of people have seen on YouTube. If not, it's on YouTube. So you can go and search it.
I'll link it in this podcast. Yeah,
I remember walking out. So this was the last day of competition, and I was the first British person in the pool that morning. Now, if you remember going back to London, every single other country, that all those athletes were wearing white hats. And what made the British athletes like stand out was their, you know, their red hats. And I came out on poolside out of the kind of doorway that they had, which was like so cool. Saw my name on the side of the door and stuff. I had my hood on, had my headphones in, listening to Kanye West Stronger. And I just remember walking out, and I just, for anyone that walked out at London, when you walk out the call-up room, it's so tempting just to look forward and then you see the first line of seats and then the next one and then the next one. And all of a sudden, like, you could be like that. So I just said to myself, just keep your head down and just walk to your block.
Okay.
So in the heat, I was in lane three. I was next to the world champion, world record holder, Pavel Poltsev. So that was a bit nervy because that was probably like the second time I'd swum against him in my career. I'd swum against him in the Europeans a year before, but this is the real deal. This is what we were all training for. So I just kept my head down. And then I took my hood off and then went to sort my block out. Still had my headphones in at this point. And then I pulled my headphones out and I just heard this like mighty roar. Took my jacket off, took my hoodie off, took my shorts off, took my trainers off, put those in my box and walked up to the behind the block and just looked at this 50 meter by 2.5 meter space that everything else just kind of blanketed out. It didn't matter. This is the only space that I can kind of focus on and determine what goes on. And I just have to make sure I get my start right. I get my underwater work right. I have to get my breakout right. And then I'm just into my rhythm before we get to the wall. And then we do it all over again. And I remember putting my foot up on the block, having both arms by my side. And then I just heard another mighty roar and the goosebumps just came up on my arm. And I thought, like, holy, like, this is it. This is my time. I've trained so hard for this over the past 3 years to make sure that I was ready for this moment. And here we are. It's just time to go and execute.
So it helped. It wasn't daunting at all. It kind of helped you get in the moment.
Yeah. But again, it was... I didn't see it. Mm. All I saw was the lane ropes and the pool of water that I had an effect on. Nothing else kind of mattered. Yes, I heard the noise and I got the goosebumps, but it just didn't dawn on me how big the moment was. Okay. And I got everything kind of spot on in terms of start, underwater work. Got into my first 50 was really, really good, really strong. I turned, had a great turn, had great contact off the wall, did my underwater work. And then I slipped. I missed my first catch on that first pull, my breakout, my breaststroke, my first breaststroke. And I didn't let it panic. Like I'd rehearsed it so many times that's happened before and I knew how to correct it. So that by the time the second stroke came around, I was just back into my normal rhythm. Anyway, the back fifth. So the first 50 was really a blur because it's normally you're just sitting right on top of the water. Your hips are really high. You're just coasting through, going through the rhythm. And on 100 breaststroke, the last kind of 30 meters is really, really difficult. But this is probably the easiest last 30 meters I've ever done in my life. I remember just coming every time my head lifted out the water, I just heard the crowd going absolutely wild. And the commentator was Alan March. And I heard him going absolutely wild and G-ing the crowd up every step of the way so that every time my head came out of the water, I just had screams and screams of people getting me to the end. And I ended up smashing my British record at then by like 2.5 seconds. And I was just off the shoulder of the world record holder, world champion. So all in all, it was an amazing, amazing race. But it was a case of just focus every day pretty much for those last 3 years to make sure that I just executed at the right time. And credit has to go to my coach for getting me in a, you know, mentally prepared for something like that. Cause we had a chat when we got down to London from our holding camp. She was like, how do you feel? I'm like, that's kind of a big deal. This isn't it. It's, you know, it's London 2012. It's like all we've heard about for the past 5 years. It's now time to go and like shine. She was like, well, what's the first goal you remember? And I said, like me, at Blackpool Palatine pool when I was like 9 or something. She's like, well, it's just that, but the pool's twice the size and there might just be a bit, you know, a few more people watching, but it's still in essence the same. It's 2.5 meters wide. It's 50 meters of water. How many long course pools have you swum in your life? And I was like, she was like, it's just another one. Just go and do what you've been doing over the past few months and you'll be absolutely fine. And turns out I was, and then raced in the final in the nighttime, came fourth. Was part of the medley relay team that was also on the last day. We ended up coming fifth in the final. We smashed the record, British record by 2 seconds. So we couldn't have done much more as a team.
Yeah.
All in all, it was just a really magical experience.
Yeah, I think PBs on the biggest stage, you can't really ask for much more. And to know that you had 3 years of build up and that kind of you were going on the team. You weren't guaranteed, but obviously that was the goal you were going. And for in the moment to not feel any pressure, really. and to build up to it. I think that's a massive testament to your coaching.
Absolutely. And the biggest thing was I was going in to London, like world ranked 12th, I think, at the time. Mm. So to drop that much time and to come out finishing fourth was, it's a bit gutting. You finish fourth. It's like you just missed out on the podium. But at the end of the day, I heard my name being called out for a final session at the final session of London 2012 as a whole. My name got called out twice. What more can any athlete want that was going into the championships ranked 12th? So I was absolutely thrilled with my performance and how I did in London. And like I said, it was just really special. There's a story as well where I swam three times. I had three individual events during London, and one of them was 100 backstroke. Now, for any breaststrokers out there, you know how poor we are at backstroke. Like, it's just the bane of our life. But what was funny is when I started having problems with my left arm, one of the doctors said to my mum that, mum and dad, that, Jack's never going to be able to swim backstroke straight because he's got a bent arm. And yet, one of the middle days during the games, standing in front, again, 17,500 people about to swim 100 backstroke. Like, who would have thought it? It's again, that's something I talk about when I go and talk to other people suffering from hemophilia, that doctors don't always know everything. And if you have an opportunity to prove people wrong and knock down barriers, it's a cliche in Paralympic sport, but it really does sit true that so many people have put barriers up in front of us. And what's special about Paralympic sport is that we've knocked down every single one of them to be at that, to be on the world stage.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, that kind of segues really nicely into my next question, which is, how are you spreading awareness of having and living with hemophilia now? Is it because you're no longer involved with swimming? How are you actively kind of increasing the exposure of it and spreading the word of these amazing achievements that you can achieve with this condition?
Absolutely. And so I'm a celebrity ambassador for the UK Hemophilia Society. And I have the opportunity on lots of different occasions just to speak to people who deal with hemophilia on the day to day. So my first engagement that I can remember with other hemophiliacs was in the November of 2012. And I just thought I was going there just to say, hi, I'm Jack, I've got hemophilia, like, it's cool. But that impact I had on that weekend was huge just on me. It was nice just to sit in a room with other people who'd gone through the same pains, the same aches, have to deal with the same thing on the day-to-day that I did. So, the boring kind of having to inject yourself on the day-to-day, having to say no when you want to go and play rugby, or having to miss like going out with your friends or going on a bike ride because you're too scared, you don't have enough kind of factor in your blood to make sure you're covered in case something bad happens. It's always being careful. It's not going on bouncy castles. It was really liberating. And it doesn't matter if they were kind of 4 or 5 years old or was, people in their 30s and 40s, I could just sit down and just talk to them about what it's like to have hemophilia. It was really liberating for me. So I see it myself as it's my duty as someone who has the platform and the opportunity to talk about hemophilia, not just what swimming can do for a hemophiliac, but in terms of a more wider public looking in on the hemophilia community, I feel it's my job to say, we're here, this is what we do. We're a community full of amazing people and full of inspirational people, not just people who, at top of the sporting world, but people doing amazing things like raising tons of money for charity. It's just so important. And I'm also pleased to say that I'm part of a campaign which aims to raise awareness for people with rare disease.
Okay.
So that's a campaign called I Am Number 17, where 1 in 17 people in the UK are affected in some way by a rare disease. So there's thousands and thousands of rare disease. Some people, some we don't even know yet. And to be able to be asked to talk about my specific rare disease, hemophilia, on a massive scale, I was on Sky News in January 2020 at the launch, just talking about rare diseases and just talk, just creating conversation. That's the main thing that I like to do, and give people hope that if someone has had a baby and they get diagnosed with a certain rare disease, it just isn't the end of the world. There's so many things you can do. I'm just so proud and privileged to be in a position where I can do that for people.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to hear your achievements in the swimming pool, but then I think you've pushed it even further since you've left the swimming pool. Is it kind of like cathartic to you to keep talking about it, keep being engaged with a community and speaking about it with others? I think that's the sense that I'm getting right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And my job allows me to do that as well. So I deal with a lot of pharmaceutical companies who, yes, their job is to sell the products they make, but most of them are really keen on patient advocacy and making sure that, yes, the product's right, but everything else within that support network. So making sure that all the physios have the right qualifications and the right knowledge to make sure that if they go into hospital with a certain problem, those physios can help them out and make sure that they're not in pain for too long.
And the
job I'm in at the minute is I can put my personal spin as someone who suffers from a rare disease and help the farmers realize this is where we want to go, this is where we need to go. And every opportunity I get to talk about, either I'm number 17 or stuff to do with hemophilia, it's just, like I say, it's an absolute privilege. And I see it as my job because I've got this platform, because I've got this talent to speak in front of thousands of people. I feel it's my job to do so. So yes, you could say it's cathartic, but I feel like it's something I need to do to give back to the community for all the support that they gave me during my swimming career.
Nice. I like it. So like I said, at the top of this program, you were going to help us with our knowledge of paraswimming, and you've been through the classifications, but at the para meet in Manchester for the para swimmers, they were kind of swimming on a point system.
Yep.
Can you explain a little bit more about that for kind of the average viewer? It's a little complicated.
It's really, really simple. So when you look on the result sheet, you'll see FINA points.
Yep.
So the FINA points are based off a world record.
Right.
So if you, the world record standard is 1,000 FINA points, and it's the same with multi disability points. So each classification for each different event will have a different world record. So the S10 100 meters freestyle record is something like 48 seconds, but the S6 under freestyle, like 110. Someone goes like 56 seconds and they're an S10, they'll get, I don't know, 700, 500 points, something like that.
Yeah.
But if someone goes like 109 and who's an S6, they'll get like 1,100 points. So if you think of it as like a FINA points where each swimmer, yes, the time is the most important thing, but next to that, it's pretty much the same thing, but it's just based on each classification's world record. So each world record in each different classification is 1,000 points. The slower you are, you lose points. The faster you are, the more points you get than 1,000. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Because kind of in able body, or from my experience, the whole FINA point system, especially when you're an age group swimmer, is completely skipped over.
It's not important because everyone's swimming against each other on a fair scale, where in para swimming, someone could finish 40 seconds after the first person to touch the wall, but because they're so much closer to their world record, they're going to win the race because, you know, they're producing a more world-class time for their classification. Yeah. It's just because we don't have the numbers that we need to have 8 different S10s in a 100 meters race. But that's probably one of the reasons why the Paralympics is one of the longest swim meets in the world. It's 10 days.
Mm.
The Olympics is what, 7-8 at a push?
So
to have a 10-day swim meet, you need to get all the different classes. So when you're at the Paralympics, you're in each discipline classification has their own individual race. So whoever touches the wall at the Paralympics first is the gold medal winner.
But at meets, say like Manchester, it's done on point system because there isn't the volume of swimmers.
Exactly. So they have to swim together. It's just the fairest way of doing it. It's not a perfect system, but it's the best system we've got. And it's the most logical system.
Yeah, it makes sense. You
could just have a freak in one classification who just posts ridiculously quick times, and because you may be ranked like second in the world, but if you're 5 seconds slower than the world record holder, it's just a bit, you know. But that's just the way it is. So I was ranked number one in Britain, still am. I've still got the fastest time, but I barely won a national gold medal because I was swimming against people who were like world record holders.
So something we did see also at Manchester was para swimmers swimming by themselves, which was, it was quite a hard sight to see. Is there kind of the possibility, I know in the heats they did swim against the able body swimmers, is there a possibility that the finals could be merged as well?
They probably should have been.
Annoyingly, they weren't. I mean, even on, I think it was like the 50 meters butterfly, on the able body, there was one swimmer, and then the paras had two swimmers afterwards. It was really bizarre that they couldn't put them in just one final.
That may be bizarre, but again, it's probably down to scheduling and getting the individual athletes ready for, you know, when they race a major meet. It's
that's
an interesting one, because what used to happen is during the heats in the morning, if it was a mixed event, say if it was not necessarily a trials meet or a nationals meet, but if it was say a Burns meet or something, we'd swim in the heats, and then there might be, if there was enough of us, there might be a multi-disability kind of final where we'd, you know, swim together with the able bodies in the heats, and then we'd have like a final. It was just, you know, the para swimmers. So yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm not sure about that. But there's individual events such as the 150 IM where you can't kind of expect an S3. Obviously it's not an event at the Olympics, but that's that event you'd expect athletes to swim on their own, because, you know, it's the only classification that does those events.
While we're talking about Manchester, you had a little bit of an eye on the meet. Were there any swimmers that kind of impressed you and stood out over the course of the weekend? Because I know Dan, my co-host, picked out a fair few. I think Jordan Catchpole was one that he was really impressed with. Is there
Jordan's come through really, really well over the past few years, and I'm sure he'd be looking to build upon some strong performance he's had since the Rio Paralympic Games. But for me, you can't look any further than the names that have been around para swimming for years. You look at Ellie Simmons, you look at Hannah Russell, you look at Ollie Hind. These people are going to pay. The way was paved by people like Sasha Kendrick, like James Anderson, like Liz Johnson. And now to see the generation, my generation, stepping into those shoes, paving the way for the future generation. You know, Maisie Summanita's, you know, puts in amazing performances in the 100 breaststroke, which is obviously, I'm going to look at the 100 breaststroke. It's my event. But to see Ellie competing, that, because that space was during my time on the team, was all about Liz Johnson and Charlotte Henshaw. Those two were the strong, really strong S6s. So to see Ellie and Maisie now step into those shoes and be really competitive on the world scale, be really competitive on the world stage, is really pleasing to see. But I just think it's a really difficult time, because there are a hell of a lot more para swimmers out there who have a lot to offer. But just because of the pandemic and the way everything's kind of shaped out, it's just a real shame that we didn't see a different array of athletes that, you know, you might not have seen. I'm just really excited to see what happens at the trials in the future. It's exciting, and it's a really busy year for them in terms of having to get, you know, having to deal with the pandemic, but also getting all the training in before a major meet. And not just any major meet, it's the major meet. It's just a really, really difficult time for everybody, but the same could be said for able-bodied swimming. I mean, look, PT swam really, really well against dropping 58 points as if it was nothing. The guy's an absolute freak, but he trains like a freak, so good luck to him. It's just a really exciting time, both with the Olympic squad and the Paris squad. I just can't wait to see what happens in the summer and how it works.
Yeah, so GB swimming and para swimming is in a really good place going forward into Tokyo. I know certainly when me and Dan have been looking at the able bodies, there's tons of medals that we can pick out. Are there any kind of nailed on that you have in mind?
I mean, it's such a toss-up. And that's one of the fun things about para swimming, is because you can rock up to a para meet and someone's just been newly classified and can come and like shake the whole world up. So there's obviously the British interest with the names I've already mentioned, with Ollie, with Hannah, with Ellie, with Maisie, with Alice Tai as well. I mean, there's just so many different star names on the para squad that they're all going to be successful no matter what they do. I feel really for Ollie Hind, because he was the guy. He was Paralympic, Commonwealth, World, European champion in his old classification of S8. It'd be interesting to see how he adapts and moves into his new classification in S9. But like I said, when you actually get to the Paralympic Games, someone could just rock up that no one's ever heard, that's never been on the world rankings, and just totally come and steal the show. So it's a case of, if people want to see the stars, they just have to watch the show. That's it. And I'm sure there'll be so much content created about some superstar that's going to stand out that no one's ever heard of. And it's going to be a really exciting kind of few months in the lead up to the games.
Yeah, certainly some exciting times ahead. Before we end this podcast, it's kind of a good point to go over one last time is how does that classification work? How are you examined for it? Because like you said, Ollie Hind has changed classification. How does that come about?
So from my experience, and I do believe that the whole system had a major overhaul post Rio. So things may be a bit different, but what happens is you apply to the governing body, you apply to British Swimming and say, look, I've got this impairment, whether it be visual, whether it be a learning difficulty, whether it be a physical impairment, and say, look, I've got this impairment. Would it be okay for me to come and get classified at a para meet, usually in either November or April? And then you're assessed by a team on a bench where they look at your joints, they do some measurements, whether it's strength tests or they do, you know, measurements with a ruler or a, where they work out your angles like they did for my elbow. And then once you pass that test, you move into a water test. So those two assessors that had a look at you on the bench, watch you in the water and see how you move in the water to see where the disparity is between an able-bodied athlete and where you sit or where you might sit. And then they'll watch you during the race weekend. So if you pass those first two steps, they'll put you into the meet and accept you as a para swimmer. And then just to make sure you weren't faking anything, they'll watch you during the race, a race simulation. Now, the way it works is everyone starts with a certain number of points. Forgive me off the top of my head, I can't remember what it is.
Right.
And when you have an impairment, you'll lose points and you have to learn under a certain threshold to make sure that you've lost enough points to be put into that certain classification. So
it's really
straightforward in terms of that. But like I said, it got revamped just after 2016 to make it a bit more methodical rather than someone looking and thinking that's what I see. It makes it a bit more objective than subjective. So that's the physical impairments. You'll have to forgive me. I'm not sure that the process that go through with visual impairments and learning difficulties. Okay. I think the part of learning difficulties, they have to do like an IQ test or like a computer test. Mm. And if they don't pass that, then they don't get to swim at the meet. So I think the S14 athletes have to have like periodical reviews, whether that's every 12 months, 18 months, I'm not sure, but they have to go through these reviews. But visual impairment athletes, it's funny, when you get to an end of a race, the referee will usually check the goggles to see if they can see anything.
Okay.
Just to make sure, they're sure that they're all on the same level of we can't see, pretty much.
Yeah.
So, again, it's not a perfect system, but it's the best system we've got. And if people want to learn more about classification, there's an ex-GB para swimmer called Giles Long. He's developed a system called Lexi, which is specifically to help people understand the classification process a bit better and how someone with a certain impairment might fit into a certain classification.
Yeah, so we'll link about Lexi in the description of this podcast. I know it was on Channel 4 a lot during London 2012, and certainly that's certainly how I learned the world of para swimming. Do many swimmers go through any sort of reclassification or reviews usually during their career?
Yep. So it just depends. People develop and people grow. Normally you get classified as a quite young kid and you'll be put forward for a review maybe 2 years down the line to see how, you know, your body's changed in that period of time.
Okay.
Or you can also, if you feel like your condition has deteriorated, you can put in an appeal to the IPC to say, look, can you have another look at me to see if I'm still swimming at the same level? But like I said, the massive revamp that took place in 2016 meant that everybody on the world-class stage had to go through a reclassification process. Okay. So it's just picked out some really obscurities and new athletes that were doing really well in a certain classification further down the scale. So they're doing even more well now than they were back in their old classification. And it's people have left the sport because they're nowhere near the front of their classification. So, you know, being able to make teams and stuff, which is really sad, but that's just the sport we live in. You know, try and make it as fair as we can and move forward from there. So yes, it happens. And again, it's just the powers that be that make those decisions. And if someone says that you're this classification, there's literally nothing you can do about it. You can appeal it a couple of times, but you know, if the final word is you're in this classification, not a great deal you can do about it. Other than work really hard and make sure you're successful in that new classification.
Yeah, you would hope after the revamp of 2016, we shouldn't see too many changes now for a little while, unless there is obvious kind of body changes.
Yeah, here's hoping. But again, it's not a perfect system. If someone comes up with a more perfect system, then I'm sure the IPC will be open to ears to listen to, you know, how we can further improve the classification system, because it's really contentious and, you know, it annoys a lot of people. But at the end of the day, they're just doing their job.
Yeah, they're doing the best they can.
Exactly. And that's all we can ask as a governing body. That's all we can ask.
Yeah. Okay, Jack. Well, it's been amazing having you on the podcast. I've learned so much. And your story of London 2012 actually sent chills down me. It was really, really cool to hear.
Glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thank you for giving up your evening and for teaching our audience a little bit more about para swimming. We hopefully will have you on again in the future when we do a live stream of any para events. Yep. We will look to have you on, look to get you to give some expert analysis.
It'd be an absolute pleasure. Like I said, I'm really looking forward to the trials, and hopefully we'll be doing some more stuff around the Paralympic Games when it comes around in the summer as well. So
definitely.
If any of the para swimmers listening, I just want to wish you all the best and all the luck for the trials. I hope that when the team announcement gets made, that your name's on the list and you get that same buzz that I did before the London Games. So good luck, and I wish you the best of British.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for listening to this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on YouTube or all of the usual podcast providing platforms. All that's left for me to say is thanks so much, Jack, for joining us, and we look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Perfect. See you soon, guys.
You've been listening to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast with Scott and Dan. We want to thank you for joining us and invite you to subscribe to the show, as well as checking out the Propulsion Swimming YouTube channel for weekly tutorials and videos to get your swimming fix. We will be back next week. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.
I swam 1,416 lengths of my local pool, that's 22 miles, the width of the English Channel. In 12 weeks, you could conquer the English Channel too. Rediscover the joys of swimming from April by taking on Diabetes UK's life-changing challenge, Swim 22, in your local pool, and find a fitter you with every stroke. Click the banner or search Swim 22 to sign up for free today.